Hey, happy Friday, everyone. Sunshine on a Friday afternoon, the weekend ahead of us. What could be better? Not much, right? We've got a great, yeah, that's how I feel too. Rich Luzinski on board this afternoon, Danielle Mason on board, Brian Morton, of course, helping us out as he always does, as well as Dave Rieger. So our appreciation to everybody who helped out this week altogether and made it really a great week for me. So I really appreciate it. Hey, in terms of what we're watching this afternoon, sign, sealed, delivered. Changes have been made to Michigan's minimum wage, tipped wage, and sick time laws. We've been hearing about this for better than a year, and things got really tight last night as they were the state legislature was up against a midnight deadline, but it got done. The job got done. Two bills to amend Michigan's minimum wage, the tipped wage, and sick time laws were changed, and they are now signed by Governor Gretchen Whitmer this afternoon. The bills go into effect immediately. They are retroactive. Michigan lawmakers passed the pair of bills on Thursday as well as Friday. They changed the minimum wage increase schedule. They capped the sub-minimum wage phase out at 50%, and then they make changes to the sick leave law, to the state's sick leave law. We're going to be hearing all about this. We're going to really get into this with Bill G. Schutte, the Republican from Midland. He was right in the thick of all this, and he'll be joining us shortly, in fact, to talk about what this means for the state, and the job is now done, and a lot of effort went into that. So we're going to be chatting with him coming up this afternoon. Also, a lot going on in politics. We're gonna talk a bit about it here. Both the Michigan Republican Democratic parties are holding their state conventions in Detroit this weekend with the same item on their agendas. They need to elect some new chairs, and of course, that is going to be what leads the party going forward. The GOP meeting is being held at Huntington Place. The Democrats are at the Marriott at the Rensen. Current Democratic chairwoman Lavora Baines announced back in November that she did not want a fourth two-year term. The former state senator Curtis Hertel and community organizer AIBJ Williams, they're both competing to replace her. So we're going to see who comes out on top there. Republicans, interesting race there. They're going to choose from three candidates to replace Pete Hoekstra, who was President Trump's choice as the ambassador to Canada. He stepped in, of course, when the party was really in disarray more than a year ago. Pete Hoekstra stepping in, taking the party over. The GOP candidates right now are former party co-chair Michonne Maddock, State Senator Jim Runstead, and longtime GOP activist Joe Sella. What's interesting, though, President Trump endorsed Michonne Maddock's campaign for the chair of the party. And, of course, that boosted her prospects ahead of the state convention vote on Saturday. Maddox, a controversial former co-chair of the state party who is criminally charged with falsely claiming to be a Michigan presidential elector after the 2020 vote. She's one of three candidates, as we said, to succeed Pete Hoekstra. Here's what she said on X, on Facebook, rather. She said, "I'm not going to lie, this made my heart skip." She's talking about the Trump endorsement on her social media platform, as well as on Truth Social here. Trump posted on that Maddock has his complete and total endorsement, adding, "She will never let you down." So that's what's being said on social media about Michonne Maddock. And it's going to see what happens this weekend in those meetings. Again, they happen tomorrow, both at the Rensen and at Huntington Place. The GOP's at Huntington Place, and the Democrats are at Rensen. Also, a lot of people talking about the disorganization in the Democratic Party, the kind of rudderless issue with the party after the big loss in November. So some Democratic lawmakers are really expressing concerns about the party's messaging ability. New York Congressman Tom Suozzi, a Democrat, joined Fox News today to defend the Democratic Party platform. He says they might have to change a few things, but overall they're going in the right direction.
Yeah, I think we have to get back to the basics and talk about the things that people care about. They care about their wages, they're concerned about the border, they care about their public safety, and we have to talk about those things. And I think the Democratic Party's ready to do that. When you think about it, you know, the Democrats want to raise the minimum wage. The Republicans don't. The Democrats want to encourage unions. The Republicans don't.
So while all this is happening, a lot of Democratic lawmakers have gone basically on the offensive. They're resisting Democratic, the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, claiming that the group is acting unconstitutionally. They're doubling down on that. So a lot of talk today about what direction the Democrats are going to be going in, and certainly here in the state of Michigan, but also nationally as well. The man accused of fatally shooting the CEO of United Healthcare in New York City and leading authorities on a five-day manhunt. He's scheduled to be in court today for the first time since his December arraignment on state murder and terror charges. 26-year-old Luigi Mangione is set for a hearing in the state court in Manhattan. Prosecutors and Mangione's defense attorneys are expected to provide updates on the status of the case, and the judge will be setting deadlines for pretrial paperwork and possibly even a trial date. A lot of this is just really court business that's going to be happening today, but it's very important court business, and there may be some evidence that could be brought forward or some piece of evidence that could come forward that could change this. But again, we might see a trial date here coming up today. Mangione pleading not guilty to multiple counts of murder, including murder as an act of terrorism. On December 4th, he allegedly shot and killed Brian Thompson outside of a Midtown Manhattan hotel. The executive was ambushed as he shot, as he was walking along the sidewalk, walking to an investor conference in New York City. Mangione also facing federal charges that could carry the possibility of the death penalty. He's being held in a Brooklyn federal jail alongside several other high-profile defendants, including Sean Diddy Combs and Sam Bankman-Fried. So he's got some company there in terms of high-profile cases in the jail where he's being held. Interesting development this afternoon on that case of the three children who were left abandoned by their mother, allegedly abandoned by their mother. The Free Press's Violet Ikonomova reporting today that at least twice, Pontiac inspectors visited that townhouse where the kids were living. And this was when they were living there alone. And it's raising questions as to whether these kids could have been found or should have been found. The two visits was one in 2022 and another one last summer. And this happens, of course, in the time frame where they were left alone. A city inspector last summer came to the house to check on a newly installed front porch. The city says they did not go inside at that time. They didn't go inside, but they were on the porch. And also there was another issue with registering this facility or this townhome as a rental. There was some problems with that, and that caused the inspectors to go out. So they're looking into this right now. The city, a spokesperson for the mayor's office, said that they're investigating whether any current or city employees may have been responsible for not following up on the property. And because it was flagged as an unregistered rental years ago. And the city saying they're going to be held accountable if they find out that maybe they didn't do their job in its entirety. So a lot going on this afternoon. When we come back, as I said, we're going to talk a little more about the tipped wage that has gotten passed in the state of Michigan. That's coming up next here on WJR. Michigan lawmakers passing a compromise bill late last night that would preserve the state's tipped wage credit, adjust scheduled increases to the minimum wage, and amend the requirement for most employers to provide paid sick leave. And now the governor signing that legislation into law, and so it's a done deal. We'd like to welcome Bill G. Schutte, Republican from Midland, worked very hard on this legislation. Hi, we're glad you could join us, Bill.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show. It was a late night on the floor of the Michigan House last night, but I'm glad we could get a compromise solution through for our restaurant workers and family-owned small businesses.
So before we get to actually talking about this, I want to ask you a quick question about, you know, the hard work that went into this. And when I say hard work, that's, you know, I'm sort of glossing over the lot of, you know, really sharp, difficult talks and difficult work that went into this. So when you have this kind of battle, because this was a pretty big battle between the Republicans and the Democrats in our legislature, how do you, like, go now on Monday, you're all going to have to go back to work on other things and not hate each other, because you're going to have some work to do.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think this was actually kind of the first trial balloon of divided government that we have right now in Lansing, with a Republican-controlled state house, a Democrat state senate, and Democrat governor. And we had a looming cliff facing our restaurant workers and small businesses. So this was one of those classic scenarios where everybody had to dig in. Everybody has their principles. You don't compromise your principles. But it's sort of one of those things, you know, like when my mother was brokering some sort of compromise between my sister and me. You know, she said, "I know I did a good job when both of you weren't completely satisfied." And but, you know, that's, you know, at the end of the day, we made the situation better for the people of Michigan, and that's something to rest your hat on.
All right. So what were you satisfied at the end of the evening here with what got passed and what the governor signed?
Yeah, a couple of things. One, so important that we preserved the tip credit, because if the legislature had not acted, we would have seen an elimination of the tipped wage in the state of Michigan. And that really would have hit our restaurant workers so hard. That would have meant, and, you know, I chaired the committee that heard testimony on these bills, and you eliminate the tip credit and you look at other states or cities that have done so, you see the behavior of those who visit restaurants completely change. And that means your restaurant workers, who are on sometimes on a slow day making $30 an hour, on a good day making $90 an hour, they're losing that really important source of income. And then that cost of increased payroll cost goes on to the customer. So now you're paying, you know, $30 for a hamburger. Nobody wants to do that. Or we're moving to quick serve stations. So preserving that tip credit was very important. And then secondly, on the Earned Sick Time Act, this was really about providing more flexibility for family-owned small businesses, and making sure that, you know, if you're a worker who is enjoying a generous paid time off policy, you're able to you're able to continue to participate in that program instead of following a highly prescriptive one-size-fits-all model.
So, and this pertains to businesses with over 50 employees. Am I correct on that, or is that correct?
Yeah. So this was, this was one of the kind of the sticking areas and areas where we really, again, had to dig in and make sure we were finding a form of compromise. Businesses that have over 50 employees have to provide some form of paid time off, 72 hours. Which most of our businesses of over 50 employees already do that, but they can provide that front-loaded instead of tracking it in five-minute increments and being forced to put up with 3 days of no-call, no-show, which would have been if the legislature had not acted. And that's just completely unworkable. You can't run a business like that. You can't, you know, have your 911 dispatchers and your ambulance and emergency services providers have to put up with that. And then for, you know, those businesses of 1 to 10 employees, we also gave them it's a reduced amount of time of 40 hours, and they have a longer ramp up and period to deal with these changes. And if you're a new business that just opened in 3 years, just opened, you have 3 years to deal with this this new change. So again, this was a compromise, but one that was aimed at providing more flexibility for our family-owned small businesses and the employers and the employees.
And small businesses, of course, now are really, really feeling the pinch. I live in a town that has a lot of small businesses, and in fact, I was just in one earlier today, and, you know, everyone, all of those store owners tell me how difficult it's been, especially the first few months of the year. It's really tough.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And this is, and then you think about our restaurants. I mean, what was an industry that was just absolutely hammered by the COVID-19 shutdowns and the arbitrary forced closures? Then you want to hit them with an elimination of the tip credit and an upending of their business model. I mean, it was really, really important that the legislature acted. I will say, I can understand that it's frustrating. It seems like the legislature is like a middle schooler with a homework assignment. They wait till the very last minute to get it done. I will say, you know, for your audience's awareness, you know, the House Republicans, we had our solution passed out with more than a month to spare. It took us, we were waiting on the Senate for them to send the bill back to us until like 11:15 last night. But hey, we got it done. We got the assignment turned in on time.
You sure did. And of course, the governor has signed that legislation this afternoon. So it is done. So now that you've all dusted yourselves off, what is the next thing on your plate? What we can look forward to and the legislature that we're going to see some action on?
Yeah, I think, you know, the conversation is going to shift towards the budget and especially the conversation on road funding. You know, we're facing another, you know, road funding cliff where the bonding that the state has entered into is going to come up due. And we still really have not fixed our local roads. You know, you see major projects on our large highways, but our local roads are still really in need of repair. And this is going to be an important area where we figure out how are we prioritizing our spending and our budgets to fix the roads. And, you know, we've seen the size of the state's budget grow and grow, but we've seen it go to investments like splash pads. And I read in the, you know, Detroit Free Press today, bonuses to high paid bureaucrats in Lansing. That's not the right priority. Let's spend that money on fixing the roads.
Yeah, that was, I read part of that article as well. And that's, you know, that is exactly what, you know, your constituents don't want to see and they don't want to hear. And in addition, though, this whole issue with the roads continues to be a problem. And what's interesting is now that we're seeing a thaw in the weather a bit, the potholes are out in force. So this is going to be a top of mind issue right now.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things, you know, I'm the third youngest member of the House Republican caucus. If life comes at you fast, before this last election, I was the youngest. Now I'm the third youngest, but I'm still old enough to remember, in 2018, the governor ran on fix the darn roads. Well, the roads aren't fixed yet. So we need to actually get serious about solving the issue. And, you know, the House Republicans, we have put out a plan that you know puts more than $3 billion into fixing the roads without raising taxes. That's how we can get this done. That's how we can fix those potholes, but also respect the wallets of hardworking Michiganders.
Yeah, well, this has been a long time coming. So many people are absolutely over it, as they say, as the kids say. You know, we're over it. We need to get this job done and to get it fixed once and for all so that, you know, because people visit from out of state. I have family that comes in from overseas, and they just simply can't believe what kind of condition our roads are in. So it's about time. We will definitely be having you back on, Bill Schutte from Midland, to talk a little more about that in the coming weeks. But I'm sure you're glad this whole thing is over with the paid sick leave and the minimum wage. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today. Have a great weekend.
Really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me on the show.
And we'll be right back here on WJR. A family in Southfield is grieving and frustrated, and Southfield police are angry as they continue to investigate a year-old shooting in which a 15-year-old boy was shot in the head and then later died. Tyler Johnson was a group of four friends. They were unsupervised at a room at the Westin Hotel in Southfield on February 11th of last year when he was shot. Southfield Police Chief Alvin Barron joining us because he would like to close this case, at least get it to the prosecutor's office. Chief Barron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me during this difficult time for that family, but absolutely.
Oh, 100%. And this case has always fascinated me for a number of reasons, because first of all, it's this entire dynamic about people not coming forward with information that would help solve this case. So let's set the case up a little bit. What has prevented the Southfield police from bringing the case to the prosecutor's office for charges?
Yes, and I'm glad you asked that question, because there's so many myths associated with this case as to what the police department and the prosecutor's office can and cannot do. So the issue that we're having is that once we secured evidence and search warrants, when we talk about the cell phone evidence, we were able to discover that there was no video of the shooting taking place. However, we were able to pull photos of all of the young men handling weapons and posing with weapons inside of that hotel room. As a result of that, when we made the arrest that morning of one of the teens in possession of the weapon that ultimately took Tyler's life, the hurdle is, how do you know without a certainty that this individual mm-hmm. was the one who was handling the weapon at the time it was discharged, when the evidence shows that they all had access to the weapon? And so out of five teens, certainly four witnesses remaining, someone has to step forward and tell law enforcement who was handling that weapon at the time it was discharged and why. What were the circumstances surrounding that discharge of that weapon for us to move forward?
And the police, the Southfield police, believe that all the people who survive know who that person is.
Without question, they were all in that room. You know, we were able to secure evidence that earlier that morning that the teens had breakfast in the hotel lobby. The shooting occurred roughly around 8:30 a.m., and all of the teens, per our investigation, were inside of that room. And so once we arrived after the initial 911 call took place, our officers responded to the hotel very quickly. They were able to detain two teens that were exiting the hotel. And again, one of them had two weapons on his person, ultimately one being the weapon used in the crime and then another additional weapon. The other teen, although he did not have any weapons on him, we did identify and then release him to his parents. And then as a result of great police work, because the other two witnesses or teens that were part of this had already fled, but we were able to track them down at their residence and then attempt to interview them. But as I explained in my press conference, all of the teens, through their parents, have obtained lawyers and are refusing to talk to us. And that information is so valuable because, again, the prosecutor has to be able to present this case to a judge or jury. And without that eyewitness, we're in a stall pattern.
Yeah, you sure are. The victim here was 15 years old, 15-year-old Tyler Johnson. How old were the others in the room that day?
So at the time of incident, Tyler was the youngest at 15, and the remaining young men were all 16.
Okay, I know I probably heard this, but I can't remember. How did they get into this hotel room? Somebody had to rent it for them.
Yeah, our investigation revealed that the uncle of one of the young men rented the room and then gave them access to the room.
And these weapons, who did they belong to? Do you know who they were registered to?
Well, the weapons, through our investigation, revealed that the weapons were reported stolen about 6 months prior to this incident. The investigation did not reveal who or how these teens got their hands on these weapons,
But
they were reported stolen. And through our investigation, the owner of the weapon has no association with the teens involved. So right now it's unknown of how they actually got their hands on the weapon.
You know, I can really understand how difficult it must be for a parent to not want to basically deliver their child to the police for a crime. I can truly, truly understand how difficult that must be. I'm a parent, I know. But on the other hand, I don't understand, if someone's been killed, why you cannot do the right thing and be the example here to say, you know, you have to stand up for what happened, and you need to stand up like a man, if you want to use that terminology, and we'll be here with you. Your family's right here with you, but we have to come forward with the information we have. I mean, the family of the victim here, I just can't imagine their pain. You must be dumbfounded. The department has to be dumbfounded over this.
Yes, and you know, and I'm glad you narrated your thoughts in that manner, because I'm able to now say, well, here's the difference between a random street crime and an incident that occurred amongst all friends, where somebody was handling this weapon, whether it went off intentionally or unintentionally, somebody was handling it. But these are all friends. And so our investigation revealed that these guys have been hanging out for a long time. They were very close. So although there is, you know, some concern about having the courage to come forward and tell what happened, because we all associate it, they all know the mother. They all have family and friends that are associated. And so because of that reason and that reason only, I believe someone out of four witnesses, one of them should say, hey, this isn't right. We know, we respect their mother, we respect their family, we were all friends, we loved him. He was a great friend to us. We loved him, so here's what happened. And so that's the difference, in my opinion, as to why these teams should give us the information that we need.
100%. I'm in agreement with you on this one. And again, you know, with full acknowledgement as to how difficult it must be to tell your child, look, no, you've got to go to police. You've got to step forward. We're going to be right here with you, but you've got to come forward. And again, for this, the mother and, you know, the family of 15-year-old Tyler Johnson, it's just utterly devastating what has happened here. And in addition, if that isn't bad enough to lose your child, to know that this other nonsense is going on is really difficult. Southfield Police Chief Elvin Barron, is there a number people can call if the spirit moves them? Is there a number people can call?
Yeah, you can call Crime Stoppers if you want to have some level of anonymity. And there is a reward that is being offered through Crime Stoppers. Or you can call the Southfield Police Department or any law enforcement, and they'll forward the information to us. But at the end of the day, we need an eyewitness to this to be willing to come forward and give us the information that we need.
Yeah. You know, there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of unsolved crimes in the Southeast Michigan area, thousands of them. This one is solvable, and I can understand your frustration, Chief. Nothing but the best to you. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for having me and also giving me the opportunity to continue to plea to this family and the friend to come forward. Thank you.
Yeah. Tyler Johnson is the name. We're not going to forget that. Thank you. And we'll continue here on WJR. President Trump wants to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education, a proposal that, at the very least, has an awful lot of complications. We want to bring in Melissa Nan Burke, Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News, talk a little bit about how Michigan will be affected if the Department of Education closes. Melissa, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So when I see this story and read about this story and read the work, of course, that you're producing about this, I see these words that see things like dismantle, reorient, words like that. And I keep thinking, well, what does that exactly mean? Do you have any thoughts or ideas of what that exactly means?
Yeah, it's a bit of an unknown, in part because we don't know how this will all play out. We don't know, you know, what there's an anticipated executive order that could, you know, is said to be waiting to be issued at the White House. We don't know exactly what that says. Part of the problem for the White House, for President Trump, he's obviously made it clear he wants to do away with the Education Department, but it was created by an act of Congress back in 1979. and it can only be officially kind of eliminated by Congress. So it, part of this depends on, you know, what exactly they want to do. The thinking is that they don't have the votes right now in Congress, the 60 votes in the Senate that they would need to totally eliminate it. And so what the administration could do is instead is try to depower it in some other way, you know, either by eliminating employees, either by moving functions, parts of divisions of the agency, for example, to other agencies, to try to, you know, basically take the power out of the hands of the bureaucrats that work there.
So Education Secretary nominee Linda McMahon, who is a former WWE executive, says she's the one who used the word reorient the agency. So that was what I was wondering about, what that would exactly mean. So if we air quotes reorient the agency, what is that going to mean to Michigan?
Again, it depends a little bit on what they decide to do. There's a couple proposals that we can look to, that Republicans have, legislation that Republicans have introduced in Congress that gives us some clues. You know, some ideas would be to take, for example, the department's civil rights investigations and move them DOJ, to the Department of Justice. You could take the program that provides special education dollars and shift that to Health and Human Services, those kinds of things. There's a lot of training money for adults, actually, that people might not know about, that the department is also in charge of, those kind of programming that could move maybe to the Department of Labor. So there's other agencies that could try to take on some of these responsibilities. The question is, you know, that some experts brought up with me is, like, are you losing, if you don't transfer those personnel, the people that are kind of experts in these programs, do you introduce a bit of chaos that could affect the states and school districts that rely on this money?
And that is the biggest question of all. I've talked to some teachers who are deeply, deeply concerned about this. I mean, funding for schools has been obviously a difficult topic for a long time. But teachers in the classrooms are deeply worried about this because there are enough problems within the education department as it is, even at the state level, that this could just toss everything into absolute chaos.
Yeah, I think that there's people that are pretty concerned, school administrators, superintendents, that are watching this very closely, in part because there are two big buckets of money that the state of Michigan and other states rely on from the Department of Education. One big bucket of money goes towards special education services and equipment. These are services that folks with that the state is required, school districts are required to provide under federal law. The state of Michigan and federal money together, I think for 2026, they are expecting to spend almost $3 billion to educate special education kids, right? And then there's also another bucket of money that goes to low-income schools, rural schools, that need extra help. And that can go for, you know, extra literacy, aids, you know, extra teachers, whatever it might be. But those are two big buckets of money that the state relies on to supplement its budget each year that comes directly from the Department of Education. And so losing those dollars or losing, you know, the people that administrate and send that money to the states and kind of monitor how it is spent could cause a lot of on the state level and the local level.
What do you think this would mean for the continued debate about public funding for chartered schools or private schools?
For the most part, charter schools are created on, like, state or local level, and my understanding is that there's not a ton of federal money that goes to a lot of those places. The main concern here is in terms of funding for public schools. There's a piece of this, of course, that affects universities and colleges, some of which are private, of course, and that's a bit of a different equation.
Yeah, like federal student loan college loans, those types of things that will affect, correct?
Yes, that the student loan portfolio is housed currently at the Department of Education. If the department goes away, of course, that debt doesn't go away. That could be transferred. For example, maybe if there's talk of transferring that to the Treasury. Again, like that, we'd be picking up a very large bureaucracy and moving it somewhere else. There's a lot of questions of how that would work, and the thinking is that there could be some hiccups. You know, money might just not get out the door as quickly.
Exactly.
Again, a lot of this really remains to be seen. They're kind of trying to game it out a little bit, but it's hard until we know what the plan is.
When I first heard this idea of dismantling the Department of Education, allowing states to deal with funding education, all I could think about were states like Michigan, where we rank near the bottom in education in this country. And, you know, giving our education department here more money or trying to figure out how to fund our education system, I'm not sure that's a great idea. There's some states that have not really done very well in this department. Sadly, Michigan is one of those states. Melissa Nan Burke, Washington Bureau Chief, Detroit News. Great article in the news. If you'd like to get a little more info on this, she's got her eye on this story. Melissa, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. Have a great weekend.
And you too. And we'll continue here on WJR. You're listening to WJR Afternoons with Chris Renwick. I'm Marie Osborne. So let's start this hour of the show off by giving something away. Sandals Resorts are made of the Caribbean, and we want to send you there. Indulge in an all-inclusive romantic getaway with the one you love on a 4-day, 3-night vacation for two at any Sandals Resort in Jamaica, Curacao, and the Bahamas, or the Bahamas, we should say, with round-trip airfare. To enter for your chance to win, text this hour's national keyword, moon, to 95819. For full details and official contest rules, visit WJR.com. We got an update on the Pope today on his condition. He remains hospitalized, double pneumonia, but he's in stable condition. Doctors there confirm there is no sepsis, but the infection risk, of course, remains. The medical team is saying the Pope does spend time out of his bed working. He is continuing to be treated at the hospital there in Rome, and asked directly during a press conference today, said, if the question is he out of danger? The answer is no. But then if you ask us if at this moment his life is in danger, the answer is also no. So that's how that question was answered today. Apple launching its first, get this, budget-friendly iPhone 16e for pre-sale. That's today, by the way. The new smartphone costs, this is the budget phone, people, $599 and is equipped with with artificial intelligence. Comes in the same week that Chinese rival Huawei rolled out its flagship tri-fold phone. This is a rare launch event. Analysts say the mid-range pricey strategy aims to woo price-sensitive consumers in countries like China and India and boost adoption in lower-end markets. But on a global scale, Apple still faces an uphill battle, luring new customers. Its smartphone sales have declined since peaking. That was in 2022, and its global shipments share has fallen from just about 19% in 2023 to 18% last year. This is according to some research that's done on that. So again, this new smartphone costs $599, equipped with some good stuff on it. But other than that, it is definitely a lower price point for people to who want to get into the market with a smartphone. Just a little bit on the lighter side this Friday afternoon. We want to talk about a couple of things. Betty White, yeah, she's already an American icon, but now she has a stamp to prove it. Ooh. The U.S. Postal Service Thursday. Are you going to be in line, Rich Lazinski, to buy a Betty White stamp?
That'll go great with my B. Arthur one and my Rue McClanahan stamp I already have.
Did they have stamps as well? U.S. Postal Service stamps?
No, I'm sorry. No. I was just joking around.
All right. Betty. Well, no, we got to start with Betty, and then the other ones will just simply come along.
I think
they should have a Golden Girl stamp, period.
Oh, I'd love it.
All right. So she's, of course, dubbed the First Lady of Television. The stamp is going to debut in her lifelong hometown of Los Angeles on March 27th. It is a collectible forever stamp. And again, just honoring the beloved actress and comedian Betty White. Love Betty White. Absolutely love Betty White. Rich, you're joining us. Tell me what's going on at the Redford Theater this weekend.
Oh, my goodness, Marie. You were talking about that wonderful contest that we do, and you had mentioned the Caribbean. I don't know about you, but this winter has just seemed so long, and it's just dragged on. Yeah, and so cold. You got this great chance to warm up in the comfort of the Redford Theater. They're hosting Caribbean Winter Fest. It's going to be tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. I think it goes until 10 p.m., and it's totally free, and you get the chance to see this guy named Dwayne Stevenson, who's a global ambassador of reggae music, and he's going to be playing at the Redford Theater. There's going to be food and face painting and all sorts of cool stuff going on there. Totally family-friendly, a wonderful, warm event to kind of kick the winter blues if you're feeling
for
it.
For sure. And we just love the Redford Theater, so we always like to give them a plug. Also, if you're staying in this weekend, there's a new movie on Netflix. I think that's right.
Yes.
On Netflix. So it's Robert De Niro taking on his first starring TV series role. So this is, you know, a big get for them. And it's called Zero Day. The series follows a beloved and highly respected former president, Robert De Niro, as he leads the investigation into a nationwide cyber attack while battling his own personal demons. So he's the head of this zero-day commission, and they need to find out who the perpetrators were of a devastating cyber attack that caused chaos and thousands of fatalities across the country. Disinformation runs rampant, and the personal ambitions of power brokers and technology, Wall Street, and the government collide. This is what Netflix, this is how they wrote that up. All right. What a great premise.
Oh, my goodness.
For a series. I can't wait for this.
Yeah, it sounds terrific. And it seems like it blends a little bit of political intrigue with some of the anxiety we felt from the coming out of the pandemic. And of course, technology. You know, every other day we're getting warnings, you know, for our emails and having to change passwords and all of that stuff. And it's all for supposedly a good cause. You know, we don't want anything like this to actually happen. But what I find fascinating about this series is if you think about your technology all crashing, your phones, your computers, everything you use on a daily basis, you're going to have to go back to pen and paper. And that's something that I think is going to be kind of fun watching in this show. How they deal with that if they can't use those technologies now.
Well, Rich, let me just tell you, us boomers, we're going to have that just, you know, no prob for us. We'll be on it.
You know what, Marie? When I was in college, I had to hand write my essays, and I remember still because I still have the carpal tunnel, so I know what that's like.
Do you remember the great blackout of the early 2000s?
Oh, yeah.
I want to say it was 2003.
Yep.
Okay. I mean, because that kind of gave us a taste of what this was like.
Yeah.
I mean, when you, okay, so you think about it, oh, we were without power, big deal. No, you were without power, but you couldn't access your cash at the ATM.
Mm-hmm.
There were all kinds of issues. And at the time, we were living in a house that was very close to Woodward Avenue, and there was a gas station on Woodward that, you know, was just like a half a block away from our house. And my kids were small at the time, and they came running. This was during, you know, the blackout, like, a you know, 8 hours in. They come running in the house and they say, "Mom, they're having fights at the gas station." And you could hear people yelling at the gas station.
Oh, my goodness.
Because people were trying to go up to the pumps to get their gas. And, of course, I think there may have been one that was working. And so people were coming to fists over not being able to get gasoline. So this is I thought this was an excellent, excellent premise for a series.
Oh, yeah. Now, the reviews that have come in have been mixed, but the show
has
only
been mixed.
Yeah, but a lot of these folks haven't gotten through the whole series yet. So a lot of people like Robert De Niro in the role. Some people think that some people think that he's getting a little, you know, long in the tooth to play characters like this. But when you think about it, our last couple of presidents have been a little older.
Really?
So
I mean, it's reality, right?
Yeah.
It's just reality. Well, I can't wait to watch it. I think I'm going to start it this weekend and see what I find. The White Lotus has started also. So I don't know if you were into the White Lotus series, but they
I don't think I'm old enough to see that.
Yeah, you know what? I think maybe, you know what? I think you're right, Rich. You can't watch it. I think there's some.
I need
some
parental guidance.
Yeah, there are adult themes, as they say, in that series. Okay, Robert De Niro, Zero Day. Rich, thanks for the insight on
that
and for the plug for the Redford Theater. We appreciate it. We'll continue here on WJR. So all week long, we have been dedicating time here on WJR Afternoons to take a close look at the explosion of online gambling in Michigan. All in, online, on the hook. Michigan, number one in the nation for online gambling. And along with that stat comes the fact that the calls to the state gaming helpline more than tripling since Michigan legalized online casino gambling and sports betting back in 2021. Another fact that just staggers is the fact that right now Michigan number one in the nation in gross receipts from the betting on phones and laptops. So the wagers reaching $6.5 billion in 2023, that's the equivalent of $822 gambled by every Michigander 18 years and older. Joining us to talk about this problem is Marlene Warner, the interim executive director of the Michigan Association of Problem Gambling. Marlene, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us about this afternoon.
No problem. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us how Michigan stacks up with other states in terms of what is being spent to deal with the problem of problem gambling?
Sure. I mean, actually, Michigan's doing quite well. I'd say that you have a number of different entities focused on responsible and problem gambling. Excuse me. Whether you're looking at what is being spent on traditional lottery products and online lottery products at the Michigan State Lottery, or you're looking at the Michigan Gaming Control Board and how they're splitting up the funds related to casino gambling and online gambling, whether that be internet gaming or sports wagering. And then you also have the money and the resources that the tribes are spending. So you have a number of different pots going towards this issue, but they are quite kind of separated in their efforts.
So is there enough being spent for online, the problem of online gambling then?
To be honest, Marie, I think that would require a lot more research. And I think that's one thing that is in deficit in Michigan, is that there's no one really paying attention to what is specifically going where. I think that there are differences in how people who make the choice to gamble behave online versus in person. And what do they need that's different than traditional treatment? What do they need in terms of interventions and messaging, customizing, interventions and the ways that people are going to reach out to players is quite different online than traditionally in a casino or in a lottery environment. I think that's one of the things Michigan certainly needs to spend more effort on, is looking into that level of engagement.
So we yesterday had the opportunity to talk to Sam DeMello, a young man, 38 years old, who grappled with online gaming addiction. And he told us his whole story. And he said a couple of interesting things. One of the things that he said was, with online gambling, the casino is always open. You don't have to get in the car. You don't have to put your coat on. You don't have to park the car, any of it. You just, I'll go sit in the living room, or I'm at the doctor's office in the waiting room. I'll just gamble. And so that's part of the problem here. And he believes that the only way to really tackle the problem is by doing a technology friendly, if you will, intervention with the gamblers. You can't ask them to go to a gambling anonymous meeting. They have to be met online.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think that right now there's a lot of barriers put up to people getting help, to Sam's point. And you really have to meet people where they're at. It's the number one biggest thing. I've been doing this nearly 25 years now. And I'd say that if you don't go where people are, and if that's online, you're missing out. And so being able to connect with them, being able to give them a step down approach. Oftentimes people don't want an all or nothing opportunity. They want to be able to customize those limit setting tools, customize those abilities to have a cool down period, customize the self-exclusion or the exclusionary periods that are offered to them, and be able to make it work for them. And I think that's one of the things that Michigan, but so is true in many states, hasn't exactly perfected yet and needs to get better at really figuring out what people need and want in order to cut down and or stop their gambling if it's become problematic.
One of the things that people, I talked with gamblers who, by the way, they are not problem gamblers. They enjoy it as most people do. They can place bets and enjoy it and then move on to something else. We want to make that point. But a lot of them told me about how targeted the advertising is to them if they have an app, that if they haven't placed a bet in a while, the casino does reach out online, offering them, you know, bonuses of one sort or another if they'll come and place yeah. another wager. Sam also explained that if you've had a big loss and you maybe stay away for a day or two, there's going to be a lot of you'll get a lot of push alerts telling you, hey, come on back. So it seems like, I don't know, is there enough regulation on this?
Well, I think that's another excellent point. I think that there are regulators all over this country trying to grapple with this. But to your point in the intro, Michigan has a lot of gambling ads coming into somebody who makes the choice to gamble, right? So you have, even if you haven't signed up for an app, but you're on, you know, maybe you walked into a casino and you have the linkages between the two, you're constantly being bombarded with advertisements. So the selling of data, the utilization of data from one platform or one space to another, and then the duration and the engagement of the messaging and how customized it is, I think is hard. I think the other piece that we hear a lot about is third-party influencers who are tracking some of your behavior, and maybe you haven't signed up for something, but you've searched gambling terms or you've looked for other things, they're seeking you out and finding you. And those are type of things that typically regulators are not coming down hard enough on, both the operators, their licensees, but also simultaneously the people that they're paying out in the web to really help influence you and drive you to their sites and their promotions. And I think this is a huge piece. And again, this is not just a Michigan issue. This is a U.S. issue. That a lot of the states are grappling with. But again, Michigan just has an overwhelming amount of gambling currently. So lots more needs to be paid attention to. Having said that, I will say that, you know, Henry Williams and the other folks at the Gaming Control Board, I think, are trying to grapple with these things, trying to figure these pieces out. And I think, you know, are looking for best practices right now and might need to kind of take the lead in the U.S. in terms of how this is done appropriately.
Any thoughts or ideas on why Michigan has this number of people gambling?
I don't have any ideas on that. I think that, you know, I'm recently engaged in this role, so I don't know that there's been as much advocacy as there could have been in terms of making sure there was a strong safety net and kind of putting the brakes mm-hmm. on any advancements. But here we are today. We kind of can't look into the rearview mirror and need to make sure that there is efforts afoot, whether that is through the regulatory body or through the legislature, to make sure that the people of Michigan are better protected if they make that choice to gamble.
And getting back to your point about targeted advertising, when I heard you describing what that is like, because you've heard from people that are subject to that and victims of that, I can't help but think, people who are dealing with an alcohol addiction, let's say, and they, you know, they just don't go into the liquor stores because they have a hard time with that. That would be like the liquor store texting them to say, hey, when are you going to be in? It's just, it's mind-boggling that that's, that that is how it, it works. Marlene... Yeah, exactly. Marlene Warner, Interim Executive Director of the Michigan Association of Problem Gambling, thank you for joining us today to give us some insight into this problem and this growing problem we have here in the state of Michigan. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you. And if anyone out there is struggling with gambling, please call 1-800-GAMBLER or go online, and we have resources there for you.
Yep, 1-800-GAMBLER is the state's primary problem gambling helpline. Thank you again, Marlene.
Thank you for the time. We appreciate it.
We'll continue here on WJR. And welcome back, everyone. February is American Heart Health Month, and there are a lot of dangers of heart disease, which remains the leading cause of death in the U.S., and all of this reminds us to adopt a heart-healthy lifestyle to reduce that risk. But that can sometimes be tough, and sometimes we need some pointers. Ashley Giardino is joining us. She's a health coach and registered dietitian with Teladoc Health. Hi, Ashley. Glad you could join us this afternoon.
Hi, Marie. Thanks so much for having me.
So, you know, every time I read that statistic, that it remains the number one cause of death for men and women in the U.S., is our lifestyle really the cause of all this? Is this is the big stumbling block?
Well, there's, you know, definitely ways that we can, you know, look at the risk factors, you know, and do the best we can to, you know, reduce those to be as healthy as possible.
Can we talk about some of those risk factors?
Absolutely. So some of the key risk factors, you know, are high blood pressure, being overweight, prediabetes, and diabetes. So the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute says that high blood pressure is often known as the silent killer, like you mentioned. It can damage, you know, the heart and the kidneys, often without people even realizing it, which can, you know, cause stroke, blindness, and even contribute to dementia, which does sound scary, but that's why it's so important to, monitor these risk factors. But there is good news, and that's that there are positive steps that we can take to manage these risk factors and ultimately reduce our chance of heart disease.
It seems to me, though, you've got to first understand that you have high blood pressure, correct? Because there is medication, first of all, but also other things you can do for yourself. But you got to know that you have this.
Absolutely. Yes, definitely.
And is that, and yes. So telehealth can help manage high blood pressure is what the bottom line here.
Exactly. Yes. So, yeah, Teladoc Health has, you know, we have an engaging and clinically powerful program proven to reduce and manage hypertension, which is more commonly known as high blood pressure. So participants in our program can receive, you know, blood pressure monitor, which is connected to our app. So they get a step-by-step action plan that gives them tips on nutrition and activity and one-on-one support from our expert health coaches, who can discuss those readings with the members and give them real-time personalized feedback and how to modify those action plans and help reduce their blood pressure.
So do you use medications to manage high blood pressure, or is it strictly through lifestyle changes?
So we can use medication. You can, you know, meet with our physicians, our nurse practitioners, who can help, you know, order tests, prescribe medication. But we also offer all of these, you know, different ways to, you know, manage those lifestyle behaviors. You can get, if you have high blood pressure, you can get our connected blood pressure monitor, work with our coaches in that way. You know, and the other risk factors, you know, if you have a higher weight, you know, lowering your weight can also help. So for weight management, yeah. You know, members can focus on those lifestyle behavior changes. They can get that connected scale to help make it easier. Again, you know, get advice on meal planning and nutrition, you know, and just that get that integrated care approach. so that the expert coach can help with different factors that affect weight management, like mental health, and have that holistic care view to help with these risk factors as well.
So it seems to me it's like, you know, most of us go to the doctor once a year to get our yearly checkup or whatever. But this seems to me to be more of a day-to-day operation. So you've got somebody mm-hmm. you can consult frequently about, oh, I'm having trouble with this or I'm having trouble with that, and get real-time answers to questions you may have.
Exactly. Yeah, we have an app that you can connect with, that you can connect and send, you know, questions to our coaches. You can schedule those one-on-one coaching appointments. If you have diabetes, you can have a connected blood glucose monitor that, you know, you can check your blood sugar and get real-time support if that reading is outside of range. So there's so many different ways that Teladoc Health can, you know, support you, whether you have prediabetes or diabetes or hypertension. You know, there's so many helpful support that, you know, ways that you can receive support through Teladoc.
Let's talk a little bit about weight management, because, boy, that's always a tough one. And, you know, it's just tough. It's tough to lose weight. I mean, that's not a news flash. So mm-hmm. what are some of the things that can be done to help at least start down the path of regulating your weight a little bit and getting on the right path to help yourself?
Yeah, definitely. So for weight management, you know, we can help members focus on their lifestyle behavior changes. Like you were saying, it's a day-to-day thing. So they get dedicated advice from our experts. So there's one-on-one coaching appointments, and you can have those as often as you need. You can log your food intake in their food logging, so you can get, you know, feedback on that. There's information on meal planning and nutrition, and like I was saying, a connected smart scale that sends your weight readings in, so you can get feedback on that as well. So we approach weight management with that integrated care approach. So members can sign up for that support with the expert coach. Like I mentioned, we also offer mental health care support, which can affect your weight as well. So that holistic view.
Are people reticent about the whole thing about having a scale connected to somewhere else? Are they worried about that in any way, or is this just a commitment they make?
Yeah, you know, it is all very well protected, and it's only shared with your coach if that's what you, you know, want them to see. We can share it with doctors if that you want that. But I think initially some people, you know, maybe a little curious about that, but really it's for their support, you know, so that they have someone, yeah. you know, checking in with them, help holding them accountable, helping set those smart goals.
All right. How can people find out about Teladoc Health?
Yeah, so Teladoc Health is the Teladoc Health is the largest telehealth provider in the U.S. So actually, 1 in 4 Americans already have access. So if you're not sure if you have access to Teladoc Health, you can. It's usually through your insurance. You can go online and check, or you can also call 1-800-TELADOC to find out if you have access.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Ashley Giardino, health coach and registered dietitian with Teladoc Health. Thanks for joining us today. Your heart is so important to you and to everyone else, so you really have to take care of it. Thank you so much, Ashley.
All right. Thank you so much, Marie.
And when we come back, we'll be chatting with Steve Courtney, our senior sports analyst right here on WJR. All right, we are back. Let's welcome in Steve Courtney, our senior sports analyst. Steve, I don't know if you've heard this yet, this cut in pertaining to last night's big hockey game. First of all, the outcome perhaps wasn't what we'd hoped for, but did you enjoy the game?
I certainly did. I've enjoyed the whole tournament, and I think the NHL, Marie, has stumbled onto something, and we'll have more on that. Meanwhile, business out of the way first, if you don't mind. This conversation, Marie, brought to you by the hardworking men and women at Bill Brown Ford. You know, my good friend Matt Garko, he and his team, they're doing great things for you each and every day. Drive with the champions at Bill Brown Ford. Shop their TrueView inventory at BillBrownFord.com today. Let's not forget about the Performance Remodeling Sweepstakes. Performance Remodeling selected Cameron Zakaria as the winner of their first annual $100,000 Window of Opportunity Sweepstakes. Performance Remodeling says, let's do it again. Log into windowsroofingsiding.com to enter to win the next sweepstakes from Performance Remodeling. There you have it.
Well, I wanted to tell you, I was interested in the politics. I mean, how can we divorce politics from all that's happening right here? So Justin Trudeau posted on X after the game last night, you can't take our country and you can't take our game. Okay, so of course President right. Trump had something to say about that today. He was on Fox News Radio's The Brian Kilmeade Show, and he reacted to what Trudeau had to say. Let's listen in.
We won the first game. The second game was a great game. It could have gone either way. Justin's a loser, always has been. And, you know, he's just a guy that really doesn't – I think he's done a very bad job for Canada.
So there you have it, the president weighing in on last night's hockey game.
The expected rebuttal, wasn't it, Marie?
Yes.
But I was very interested – you know, and what a magnificent, magnificent sight before this hockey game even started last night at TD Garden in beautiful Boston. They did it up so very well. And, you know, I think everybody was curious as to how the anthem situation was going to go. And, you know, when the Canadian national anthem began, it started with a smattering, just a smattering of boos. And then it stopped. And then you hear reports, and you kind of heard on the broadcast last night, everybody singing along. And there were, in fact, some Americans singing along to the Canadian national anthem. So, you know, that was nice to see because, after all, this is a hockey tournament. And, you know, like you mentioned, Marie, and we've been discussing throughout the week, politics has certainly come into play. At the end of the day, a few of the Canadian players said just how proud they were that they were able to get a win because, as some alluded to, there are 40 million Canadians who were looking for this result, and they got it via Connor McDavid's overtime goal, 8:18 into the extra session. And, you know, as I'm watching the overtime, you know, completely enamored with what the heck's going on here. I've seen so much hockey in my life. The Americans putting on a lot of pressure to begin the overtime session. Austin Matthews, Brady Tkachuk, each with opportunities. And I've seen it where if you don't capitalize, lo and behold, the other team goes down and scores. And that's exactly what happened. By the way, in case you're wondering, Marie, it was just the second time an NHL international tournament was decided by an overtime goal. Daryl Sittler won it for Canada at the 1976 Canada Cup. So, you know, look, Marie, how the politics of this whole thing is going to play out remains to be seen. But I was just fascinated with this four nations face off.
And you talked about what, how the NHL really has hit upon something that people really have wrapped their arms around it and are really enjoying it. I just also, you know, people are always saying that actors and actresses should stay out of politics. We don't need to hear what you have to say about anything. That's always what people say. Well, you know, it's too bad that this has devolved into so much politics. It just is so not necessary, and it was certainly not necessary to be booing anybody's national anthem, anybody's national anthem ever. So, I'm glad it's over.
Well, and as we discussed yesterday, you know, and it has been discussed ad nauseum throughout the country, throughout both countries, leading up to that tilt last night. You know, we have been great neighbors with Canada for a long, long time. As I mentioned, historically, Canada was by our side in World War I, World War II.
And maple syrup. I mean, maple syrup.
Well, let's not discount the whole maple syrup thing, for God's sakes. But, you know, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's this 51st state thing. And so many people, you know, have thought, well, you know, that's just Trump being Trump. It's a joke, yada, yada, yada. But when you have the press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, mentioning it in a briefing, you know, I don't, you know, this is what he's after. And, you know, what the end game is, again, you know, I have no idea. Then you bring the tariffs into it and everything else. So, you know, allies for a long, long time. And, you know, all of this stuff is certainly out of our control.
Can we take a quick look at the Tigers in Lakeland and what's happening down there?
Yeah, they're getting ready to go.
I mean, what is it shaping up like for the season? I mean, what is it looking like to you?
I think it's looking pretty good, to be honest with you. I mean, we missed out on the Alex Bregman sweepstakes, but the more you dive into it, you save some jing. And maybe that'll lead to a major deal at the trade deadline. I certainly think the Tigers will go in a bona fide playoff contender. And Lord knows they've got the arms, the pitching staff. They've added some great talent there. And I think there's going to be some formidable offense as well. You know, one of the questions is Spencer Torkelson at first base, you know, former first overall pick. Been somewhat of a disappointment. Colt Keith, the rookie second baseman a year ago, who was coming into his own at that position, will be your everyday first baseman. And, you know, as far as Torkelson goes, you know, he'll make this club either as a backup first baseman or as a power-hitting DH if he's able to power hit. And that is the big question. They get their spring training schedule. And that will warm your heart, won't it, tomorrow in Lakeland against the Philadelphia Phillies. And, by the way, before I forget here, Marie, your Detroit Red Wings, who hold the second wild card spot in the National Hockey League right now, they get back to regular business tomorrow, as a matter of fact. Quick turnaround for Dylan Larkin, of course, on Team USA, Lucas Raymond on Team Sweden. They host the Minnesota Wild tomorrow afternoon at 12:30.
So much great sports to look forward to, that's for sure. We've just really had a great run on all this.
Yeah, and don't forget our Spartans and the Wolverines tonight. You'll hear it right here tonight. On WJR, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, tonight right here on WJR. Thanks, Steve. Have a great weekend. We appreciate you, of course, and we love having you on board here on WJR. I'm Marie Osborne, been in for Chris Renwick this week. He's back on Monday, and Mitch Albom, Steve Courtney, Ken Brown, the whole crew back coming up your way here in just a few minutes. Have a great weekend, everyone.